Welcome to the court this afternoon. We have the panel today is on my right, Justice Dofano, and on my left, Justice Gabriel. I'm presiding judge today. We would ask all of you to enjoy your stay here today and would ask the clerk to call the docket.
The court calls Patsy Whitehead versus Gavin McKenzie and Christian McKenzie. May it please the court, Mr. David Wynn will represent the appellant and Mr. Ned Webster will represent the athlete.
Ms. Wynn.
May it please the court.
Yes, sir. Welcome.
Counsel.
David Wynn, attorney for appellant Patsy Whitehead. This case involves a dispute over an alleged roadway easement. Appellant and appellees are joint owners or owners of properties which are adjacent to each other. The trial court granted summary judgment in favor of appellee and determined that there was an easement across a portion of Patsy Whitehead's property, the southernmost boundary, which connects to the appellees, the McKenzies' tract of land. The history of the roadway is not really in dispute. Dating back to the 50s, the predecessors in title of the McKenzies, the appellees, had been granted permission by the predecessor in title of Patsy Whitehead to use this strip of land for purposes of accessing their property. Through the years, various other individuals, invitees of appellee's predecessors in title, used that strip of land for purposes of ingress and egress to appellee's property. There's also little, if any, dispute as to the initiation of that permission for the predecessors in title and for appellees to use that strip of land. It was a permissive use granted by Lowell Whitehead, which is the appellant's predecessor in title. The trial court erred by granting summary judgment in that there was fact issues that, as to specific claims made by appellee. Appellee relied upon two separate theories in claiming that this roadway easement existed. One, that a prescriptive easement existed, and alternatively, that an implied easement existed. Those two theories are contradictive in nature. The prescriptive easement relies upon an element of exclusivity. The implied easement relies upon a theory that there was public intent or that the dedication was for a public purpose. There were the elements of a prescriptive easement are open, notorious, continuous, exclusive, and adverse use. Appellee's summary judgment evidence and appellant's summary judgment evidence both clearly show that the use was by permission of appellant's predecessor in title, Lowell Whitehead. Therefore, the element of adverse and exclusive use is not met. Both documents also show, or both parties' summary judgment evidence shows, that the use was not exclusive to the appellees. The use was granted to miners who mined gravel off of appellee's property, the public over a period of time, and more importantly, appellant and appellant's predecessors in title themselves. They always shared use of that alleged roadway easement. I have two issues on appeal, and the first issue is the threshold issue, and I'm going to spend the majority of my time talking on that, and that is whether or not the trial court erred in granting summary judgment in favor of appellant. Now, there's some authority. There's a split of authority. There's actually authority indicating that uninterrupted use alone gives rise to a prescriptive easement. There's another line of authority that suggests mere use alone will never give rise to a prescriptive easement. I've cited those cases in my brief. The Johnson versus Dell case is the line of authority which states that uninterrupted use alone gives rise to a prescriptive easement. That case is distinguishable from the case from the present case in that there was no finding by the trial court in that case that the use was permissive. That goes to the element of adverse use. There was no summary judgment presented by appellees indicating that the use was adverse to appellant or appellant's predecessors in title. In fact, both summary judgment evidence, both appellants and appellees, indicate quite the opposite, that the use was always permissive. Second line, under the Rust v. Engeldahl case, shows that mere use alone never gives rise to a presumptive easement. And that case is on point with this case. The facts were similar. The appellant or the petitioners in the Rust Engeldahl case were trying to establish a prescriptive easement, and they were claiming use as their means for the prescriptive easement. The court found that mere use alone was not sufficient and was not adverse as a matter of law. So again, there's no summary judgment evidence showing that appellee's use of this alleged roadway easement or this roadway was adverse to appellant or appellant's predecessors in title. Therefore, a material element of appellee's claims that a prescriptive easement exists, there was no summary judgment evidence to support that element of adverse use. The Scott case is also on point, and the Scott case is a little bit different because the facts are similar, but in 1964, the claimants, the party seeking a prescriptive easement, filed an affidavit of record in the deed records stating that there was a easement. So that put the actual landowner on notice that there was a hostile claim being made as to a prescriptive easement. That's not the case here. There were no notices filed. There was never any actions taken by the appellees which would indicate that they were exercising a hostile domain or control over this roadway or this easement. The second theory relied upon by appellees is that there was an implied dedication. The elements of an implied dedication are that the person making the dedication must have the ability to do so, there must be a public purpose, and there has to be either an express or implied offer. In this case, appellees in their brief recognizes and throughout deposition testimony and other summary judgment evidence recognizes there's no express deed or conveyance of an easement. So they're relying upon a theory of an implied dedication. And four, there has to be acceptance of that offer. Implied dedication is a question of fact. It's not a question of law. Therefore, the trial court erred in granting summary judgment. The trial court did not distinguish upon which theory they were granting summary judgment in favor of appellee, whether it was the presumptive easement or whether it was the implied dedication. This roadway ends up at the back property, the back lot of the appellant, and at the beginning of appellee's lot. In summary judgment evidence produced by appellee, Gavin McKenzie, stated in deposition testimony that the roadway actually continued past his property line and onto his property line and made a turnaround. Yet, he also testified, and that was presented in summary judgment evidence, that he barricaded the gate at the beginning of his line, created a gate and barricaded the roadway, blocking the public off from the use of that roadway, which continued on his property. So he was then establishing a hostile takeover of that portion of the roadway beginning at his property line He never made such efforts to barricade or fence off or block the roadway on the portion that crosses appellant's property. That would have shown adverse, and that would have met the element of adverse and notorious use of the easement, which would have given him a claim for a prescriptive easement. As to the portion on his property, he's done so. I would agree that he has a prescriptive easement on the part of the roadway that crosses his property, but that's not the issue at bar. The issue is whether or not the portion of the roadway that crosses appellant's property is subject to this prescriptive easement. There have been no claims, no summary judgment evidence presented which indicates that he's ever made any hostile claims. Both parties' summary judgment evidence indicates a mutual use of the property and that it was always used by both parties and never exclusively by the appellees. I'd waive the remainder of my time unless the court has questions at this time. The appellant has actually two lots. The first lot is where her house sits, and that's at the beginning of this alleged roadway. The second lot she uses to store her work construction vehicles. She has a remodeling business. She has flatbed trailers, covered trailers, and other equipment which she stores on that second lot. Her only means of access to that second lot is along this roadway. The city of Mansfield code enforcement instructed her to build a fence 6 feet tall around that back lot to be in compliance with city code. She had begun that process and in doing so found the four corners of the second lot, constructed poles in the four corners, and then began stringing off the property lines. The southeast corner of that lot two, that back property, actually is on the south property line of appellant, which is also the south boundary of this alleged or purported roadway. She stuck the pole there in an attempt to string a line to get a straight line across there so she could then at the other side of the roadway construct a pole, and that would be the corner post. And that was also going to be the corner post of a gate, which would allow her to enter into the back property line. She at no time intended to barricade off or install a fence across the roadway.
There was going to be a gate across the roadway?
No, ma'am. The gate was going to be on the west, northwest side of the roadway, but the corner of the property line was actually on the other side of the roadway. To get a straight line between the two corners, she did put a post on the opposite side of the roadway, which I could see where that would give an inference of a fence going across there. But instead of contacting her and inquiring as to what her intentions were, appellees filed suit against her, claiming that it was her intent to barricade the roadway. Does that satisfy your question? Thank you.
May it please the court, Ned Webster on behalf of the appellees, Gavin and Patricia McKenzie. In several places in the appellant's brief, she acknowledges that the factual circumstances surrounding the origin of this roadway that exists out there, that's the subject matter of this litigation, that the facts regarding that are largely not in dispute. Until just a few moments ago, I believe there was completely no dispute about the origins of that roadway because nobody knows when that roadway first was established. What we do know from the summary judgment evidence that's been submitted in this case is that it's existed for well over 50 years now. The affidavit of Stephen Thomas is a part of the summary judgment evidence in this case. Mr. Thomas is the son of Truett Thomas and Johnny Lou Thomas, who were predecessors in title to the McKenzies on this 30-acre tract. Mr. Thomas tells us, he was born in 1951, the same year I was born. Mr. Thomas tells us that from the time of his birth until sometime in the 1970s, he resided on that, when he went away to college, that he resided on this particular tract. And that as far as he can remember, that roadway has always been on this particular, has always existed. He tells us that his father ran a dairy on this 30-acre tract, and that milk trucks would use this particular accessway, this roadway, to collect milk from his father on regular occasions. Additionally, his father worked for Tarrant County. He worked for the Precinct 2 road maintenance crew. There was the county actually purchased gravel from a gravel pit that was located on this 30-acre tract. And the county's vehicles would access to obtain the gravel would travel up this particular roadway as well. In fact, we know that the county sometime in the 1950s used the gravel that they had purchased from Mr. Thomas to actually gravel the roadway. We can tell from the affidavit of Diana Tribble, who is a neighbor out there and who's lived on her property immediately to the east of the roadway in question, that the roadway has existed for as long as she can remember, which is over 50 years, that the roadway was at first gravel. Thereafter, the roadway was paved sometime in the 1960s. City of Mansfield maintenance crews would actually patch potholes in this roadway during that period of time. And generally through both of those affidavits, we can determine that the roadway was constantly used for access to and from that property that the McKenzies now own, either by the Thomases and their invitees or folks that had occasion to come down there and visit with them or had any occasion to travel to their property. We also have the affidavit of Gavin McKenzie. He and his wife, the Appleys, purchased the property in 1998, and his testimony is that the City of Mansfield officials, in fact, maintained this particular roadway until about the year 2000. We had, as was mentioned by the attorney for the appellant, we had two theories for our motion for summary judgment for the trial court. One was that the facts and circumstances of the case, as was shown through the summary judgment evidence, indicated an implied dedication of the property, and or it indicated that there was a prescriptive easement. Now, let me make sure we understand what I'm talking about when I say the prescriptive easement. We're talking about a prescriptive easement that was obtained by the Thomases between the years 1955 or 1956 until 1965 or 66. That is the 10 years that we're focusing on, not after Lowell Whitehead bought his property. Let me go back now to the implied dedication, because I'd like to explain that. There are four elements to the implied dedication. One is that the landowner actually intended to donate the land to the public and took acts by which that intent was evidenced. Second is that he was competent to do so. Third, that there's a public benefit by the dedication. And fourth, that there's acceptance. There also exists a presumption, however, in cases like this, where we have long and continuous use of a roadway by the public, the origins of which are shrouded in obscurity. We don't know when it started. We don't know who the owner of the particular parcel of property across which the roadway runs, even who that was. If we have long and continuous public use of a roadway whose origins are shrouded in obscurity, we have a presumption of an implied dedication. Now, I do need to tell you, it's not included in the brief, and it was not brought up by the appellant in their brief, but there seems to be, I won't say there's a split of authority, but there seems to be some question about this presumption. Both the First District Court of Appeals in Houston and the Texarkana Court of Appeals hold to the position that the presumption applies to all four of the elements of the implied easement. And once one shows that, there is a presumption that the implied dedication exists. There is some of the language in some of the other courts of appeals seems to indicate perhaps the presumption only goes to the first element, the intent to dedicate. And I would like to point out a case that I did not cite in my brief, and I apologize for that, but it's Reed versus Wright at 155 Southwest 3rd, 666. And once again, they hold in that particular case all four elements are established by the presumption. But they say if we're wrong, if only the first element is established, the second element, the competence of the landowner, is presumed pursuant to the Texas Health and Safety Code, Section 576.002, which creates a presumption of competency. And they go on to say that the other two elements, the public benefit and the public acceptance, are satisfied by the long and continuous use of the roadway by the public, and that satisfies that. So it's a distinction, but it seems to me to be a distinction without substance. It seems to be the same thing. Now, with regard, even if the origins of the roadway were not shrouded in obscurity, if we knew when the roadway started and knew who the owner was, it still does not require a specific declaration by the landowner to dedicate the property. We can infer it from other acts. And the Baker versus Peace case sets out those acts. And we have them in this case. We have maintenance by public authorities. We have actual improvement of the roadway by the county when they graveled it. We have other public facilities along the roadway. We have a telephone line. We have a water line that's underneath the pavement. We have the roadway is fenced from the remainder of the appellant's property. And, in fact, if we take a look, if you look at the survey and the affidavit of Mr. Nichols, we can tell that Mr. Whitehead bought his property in two separate tracts. The first was the westernmost. And the only way he could have gotten access to that particular parcel of property at that time was by the roadway in question. He didn't buy the other parcel, the eastern portion, until 1976. So for 9 years, the only access he would have had to that particular parcel of property would be along this roadway.
Does the surveys refer to the roadway?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. It's marked in his affidavit, and I thought I had mentioned. I don't know the particular page in the record, but it is. We have the survey, and we have that particular survey is attached to every witness's.
And the records, does the record reflect how long the roadway has been referred to in the surveys?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I must have misunderstood your question. The survey does not reflect a dedication of the roadway. It reflects the lots. Mr. Nichols, the surveyor, we had to go out there and determine on the ground the limits of the pavement that existed. That's his survey. He has surveyed that, and we attached it to his affidavit.
The surveys, for example, when the lots sold, when different people purchased the lots, do the surveys refer to the roadway as a marker or an indication of?
We couldn't find in the deeds, or there's no plat concerning these particular properties. There's no plat We can't find in any official records.
No, I'm just talking about surveys.
The only place where, I think there was one other survey, but it's not in the record.
Northerly along the east edge of the roadway, or,
I have not seen any references in the legal descriptions to the roadway whatsoever.
Okay.
Just very briefly, with respect to the prescriptive easement, the appellant's right, there are two lines of cases. With respect to that, one line of cases holds that 10 years open and notorious continuous use on a piece of property creates a presumption that the use is adverse. There's another line of cases that hold to the proposition that continuous use, no matter how long, at the acquiescence of the landowner, can never rise to the level of a prescriptive easement. I would just point out I may mispronounce this, Montange, M-O-N-T-A-N-G-E case out of the Waco Court of Appeals that was in 2009 that we've cited in our brief. The court in that case looked at both of these lines of cases and held that the presumption exists, and we believe that the presumption exists. And to take some small degree of issue with counsel for appellant, we don't believe those particular elements are necessarily contradictory. One can obtain a prescriptive easement. We believe either a prescriptive easement and or an implied dedication existed at that particular point in time back in the 1950s. But there's been no evidence to rebut any of these presumptions that was presented to the trial court at the summary judgment hearings. Mr. Wynn has talked about summary judgment evidence. I would just point out that there were numerous objections to the summary judgment evidence. The court, with regard to the affidavits, the court sustained, I think, every material allegation that was made, and those are not the subject of this appeal. Second, he's talked about deposition testimony, but however, he never pointed out with any specificity where in the depositions these particular entries were made. So there are numerous cases that neither require you nor require the trial court to search through voluminous records to try to figure out whether or not there's a fact question.
Mr. Webb, do I understand your position to be that your client achieved a right of use of the roadway either by implied dedication or by prescriptive easement prior to that those existed on the land prior to the time that your client ever acquired it?
Correct.
In other words, you're not looking to your client's possession from the time that your client bought the property that is the McKenzie property in 1998.
Correct, Your Honor.
Prior to 1998, both of these grounds for the existence of a right of use by easement was already on the property by virtue of things that had happened and occurred prior to the time your client ever acquired the property.
Correct, Your Honor. And in fact, we believe they acquired those interests by way of the habendum clause, and they were rights appurtenant that were conveyed to them. Just one other case, the Greer versus Robertson case, also indicates that they have a private right of access in those. If it's an implied dedication, they have a private right of access that arises out of that public roadway.
I know your light's red, but I've got one more question.
All right, Your Honor.
There's a statement in the briefs that the 1972 express easement was granted at a time whenever the grantor to that easement didn't have title to the property.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is that in the summary judgment evidence? I didn't find it.
Well, it is not in the summary judgment evidence, but one of the things I think we would like to point out with respect to that, it's a red herring, because whether or not there is any other access, whether or not there was, it's not a material issue with regard to either of the theories. It's not an element.
I just wondered if there was a specific place somewhere where someone addressed by some examination of title that, in fact, the grantor in that 72 express easement did not have title.
Well, we noted it in looking at the deed when he conveyed it to someone else and then thereafter conveyed the easement purportedly to the public. But that particular, that has never been utilized by the public. It's a tomato. Last time I saw it, it was the gentleman's tomato garden.
Well, I'm talking about vegetables outside.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Just in follow-up to the court's last question regarding the other easement, that easement was, in fact, I don't think there's any fact issue. It was granted, and at the time, the grantor did not own the property that was affected by the easement. That was about a two-and-a-half-year period in between the time he had conveyed the dominant estate by the time he had granted the easement. That was a common tract property that was common to Appellee's property. They originally were one tract. I think that would establish a claim of hostile or adverse claim of the prescriptive easement and would have given Appellee or Appellee's predecessors in title an opportunity to then claim a prescriptive easement across that other tract of property. But that's not the subject of the appeal. The admissions of counsel in his argument clearly show we don't know when or if a prescriptive period began. Historically, we know there was common use of the property. We know it was permissive. And we don't know when, if ever, there was a prescriptive period where the roadway was used hostile to the actual owner's use or a benefit.
Mr. Wynn,
yes, sir.
Where in the summary judgment evidence is there conclusive presentation of evidence that there was permissive use of this property?
It's in the summary judgment affidavit of appellant Patsy Whitehead and of appellant's daughter. I believe her name's Patsy. I have to look at the name.
Ms. Whitehead's affidavit, it's merely speaking about the period of time from when her husband acquired the property.
Yes, sir.
And
during
it's
that,
not addressing the periods of time that were prior to her husband's acquisition of the property, and thereby not addressing the longer term of the 1955 to 1965 time period.
Had she addressed that period, I believe it would have been mere speculation. I don't believe she knows, I don't believe anyone knows, nor has any evidence been elicited or produced showing anything prior to that, whether there was an intent, whether it was a hostile takeover of this property, or whether it was, in fact, permissive use. I think it's easy to conclude or infer from the evidence that it was all permissive. There were periods of time where there was gravel mined, periods of time where milk trucks made deliveries to and from the property. And that's also important to note that with regard to the claim of an implied dedication, if that ripened, if an implied dedication occurred, it extinguished itself in the same manner. Because now Mr. McKenzie, the appellee, has blocked off that property and barricaded it at his property line. That was referenced in my brief, I believe it's page 10, where I specified his deposition testimony.
But there's also authority that the road doesn't have to lead to anywhere.
That's true, but there has to be a public purpose, and Mr. McKenzie's own deposition testimony clearly states that the way the road presently is situated with his blockade of the roadway, there's no room for turnaround, there's no room for public to do anything other than to pull up to his gate. And there's also in his deposition testimony evidence that there's no public use of the roadway now. His mail is delivered at the end of the roadway, at the beginning of the roadway, and that his garbage is collected there. There's no current public use. So, again, it would have been extinguished in the same manner that it would have been created.
So you're saying that your client or the predecessor in title to your client doesn't imply that
Ma'am, one of the elements is that there has to be, for an implied dedication, there has to be a public purpose. That's where there is no longer a public purpose because the public has no use of that roadway other than to access the appellee's gate. The appellee, by his own actions, would have extinguished the implied dedication had it, in fact, occurred. I have that in my brief. I can't remember the page number, but.
So you're saying that by blockading the end of the road, he essentially turned a road into his own driveway, to a private driveway?
Yes, ma'am, and it eliminated the element of public use or purpose. There's no public use or purpose for that easement now. Because of his own actions.
So they're taking inconsistent positions. They're claiming on the one hand it's a public roadway, and on the other hand they've made it their private driveway.
Exactly. And on page 10 of my brief, I cite his deposition testimony, which clearly states the roadway continued onto his property, yet he barricaded that by constructing the gate, and now the public is prohibited from using the remainder of that roadway, which was the turnaround. Yes, ma'am. That's correct.
You're saying that's what made it public versus having to turn around at their gate.
That made it available for use by the public because garbage trucks, postmen could get in, turn around, and exit. The way it's currently situated, there's no means or no room for a vehicle to turn around and exit without going through the gate, which only the appellees would have access to go through because it's a locked entry code gate.
How does moving the end of the, okay, if it's a road that only goes onto their property, it's still a private driveway with a turnaround. So you're saying taking out the turnaround then converts it from a public road into a private road?
No, ma'am. My claim, my argument is that one of the elements of an implied dedication is public purpose, public use.
Right, but
both of those were extinguished by the acts of appellee.
Mr. Wayne, your red light is gone, but I'll ask the. Were you through, Jack?
I'm through, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I ask your fellow counsel a question afterward. I want to ask you one, too.
Yes, sir.
The drawings indicate this is an asphalt. Who put the asphalt on it?
I would need to brief that, and I would be happy to respond to you with a written letter.
I found a part of the brief that said that the city of Mansfield.
I don't believe
the road and maintained the road for a period of time, and I took that to mean that they're the ones that put the asphalt on it.
It's more of a topping than an asphalt. It's not like a road was actually constructed. It's more of a hot tar type surface, and I'm not sure who put that down. I could brief it, and if the court wants, submit a letter to you with that information. The appellees maintained in their summary judgment affidavits that the city of Mansfield, up until the year 2000, filled in holes in the roadway. That is a fact issue that is in controversy. The appellant does not agree with that position.
Where is the evidence on the part of the appellant that the city of Mansfield did not do that?
It would just be in the affidavit submitted as summary judgment evidence.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for your briefs, your well-written briefs, and your argument, counsel, and your case is submitted. And